So I just want to start off by saying thank you to the organizers. It's a tremendous opportunity to be here. I appreciate everybody else here for taking the time, as well as everybody's talks. They've been fantastic. So I've been learning a lot, and I really appreciate that. Great. So the story I'm going to talk about today, I just first want to start off by acknowledging some of my collaborators. So Brad Storey is at the University of Arizona, and he's kind of one of the world's leaders in acoustic phonetics. And then these folks are with me at York. Joy and Jennifer kind of run the MRI facility, and Chandan's a professor in linguistics. And Chandan and I just kind of stumbled upon this opportunity. So this is a bit of a side project. It's not really kind of my focus, but I think it's a, we were very lucky to get just, I think, a very nice set of data, and it's a very unique and interesting story. And I think, given the audience here, it's a fantastic opportunity to try and kind of get some interaction and some feedback. So I greatly welcome any input, any critical feedback, any suggestions, and even to go one step further, this project's a relatively in its infancy. So if there's folks that are, you know, strongly interested, and I think there's a lot of people whose expertise would match up nicely, there's definitely a lot of room for kind of collaborative connection points along here. So if you think, you know, you're interested in any way along those lines, please get in touch. Thanks to Ralph for pointing out this link. We had actually seen this before we got started with this project. And it was so interesting and unique that I had to put it up here. So this website is definitely worth checking out. This YouTube video, it's like one of those things you'll show your friends or your grandmother or what have you. It's a little bit kind of a distraction relevant to today, though. So even though I start off with it right here, I'm going to kind of move along. Okay, so given that this is a physics institute, it seemed appropriate that we should start off our talk with Feynman. Right? So he was a very remarkable, colorful character. He could be a real asshole and chauvinist in many ways as well. But he's somebody that's, I think, had a huge impact upon a lot of people, definitely me, directly and indirectly, in a variety of ways. And many of you guys have probably read some of his books over the years, or books just kind of about him, so to say. There's even a bunch circulating around Munger. And they're the sort of books that you can just pick up and read a few pages, and it can really leave a deep, lasting impression upon you. Like, there's one where I was reading where he was talking to a group of high school teachers about what is science. And he was kind of like alluding back to his father and how kind of his father had kind of mentored him when he was a young kid. And it's just the ways that it plants these seeds in your head and thinks about how you interact with your own students. And it's fantastic. Okay? Now, our connection, Feynman's connection point here today is this book. That was written by Leighton. Leighton's the one that kind of wrote a number of the books like Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and whatnot. But this one was called Tuva or Bust. And unfortunately, this was kind of one of his last journeys, so to say, that was cut short by his untimely death. And he had kind of had this interest and this fascination with this kind of mysterious place called Tuva. And I'll come back to that in a moment. My connection point deals with these guys, right? So this is a band. Some of you guys, actually, just out of curiosity, raise your hand if you've heard of these guys before. And so maybe about a quarter of you. So Hun here too, they kind of tour around the world. We'll get back to them in a moment. But first, what is Tuva? A lot of people don't know what Tuva is. So Tuva is the center of the world. It's the geographic center of Asia. All right, so there it is right there. And it's kind of sandwiched between Russia and Mongolia. So it's in a pretty difficult place to access and get to. This is the picture from the front slide shows just kind of what Tuva looks like. It's an old place. It's an ancient place. There's a deep culture to the people that live here, but it's also a hard place to live. And Tuvans are relatively unique, hardy people in that regard. Okay? Now, these guys, Hun here too, they're Tuvan. Right? This is where they come from. They're musicians that tour around the world as part of the world music scene, and they're fantastic. They've also done a lot of recordings. It's not too hard to track down their recordings and hear it. My first exposure actually to these guys came about 15 years ago, actually, from our deputy director here at Kavli. He just kind of handed me this CD, and I was just, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget listening to it and thinking, like, wow. And I could truly appreciate why Feynman was, you know, very highly interested and kind of wanted to know more about this place. So by blind sheer luck, we got these guys to come visit us at York in Toronto last October. Okay, and it was a very remarkable opportunity. Like, it was how it all came together. It's a good story over maybe the cocktail time tonight. But what we ended up with was getting a very remarkable set of data from these guys. All right, so from all four of them, we got some fantastic audio recordings and also a little bit more, something I've already alluded to and I'll come back to a little bit later on. And a very remarkable set of data. So I want to kind of give you guys a feel for this. So let's see if we can. So these are just kind of two recordings that we made. Let's see if this works. So this first one is from one of the older guys in the group, Keigel. And it's about 45 seconds long, and you'll hear he's singing kind of a traditional song. And this, you know, this song is literally like, you know, like tens of generations old. Like there's a lot to this. You know, this isn't just kind of something made up, so to say. But you'll hear the style of singing that's kind of built in. And this is just him singing. There's no instrument or anything like it. So let's see if I can get this working. Here's one other sample. This is the younger guy. This is a short sample, but this is the youngest guy in the group, Roddick. And what he's capable of doing is really quite remarkable. And this is just a short little snippet just to kind of illustrate. And we'll come back to both of these samples later on. That's what we're gonna try and figure out. So one of the things
you know, the Tartini effect for instruments.
No,
it's Tartini. It's called one. You have an instrument that gives only one tone, and you manage to sort out several, and there are people who are able to. What's astonishing here is that he keeps the main tone at the main pitch. And the overtones are changing in pitch, right?
There's a lot of remarkable things that they do. Yeah, so I'll come back.
So that's what some people do with instruments.
Okay, Tartini effect?
Tartini.
Tartini, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But is he really changing the overtones or the formants? I would rather think that it's the resonances that changes.
Right, so we're gonna come back to that in detail, okay? So I'd like to try and kind of understand how these guys are capable of doing this. It's a remarkable thing that not many people in the world are capable of doing. There are some few, like as we started off, there's some Europeans that have taught themselves this. This is a particular style of throat singing called kume. And there's nothing, as far as we know, there's nothing special about the vocal track of Tuvix. They're just capable, they have such fine motor control that this is basically a purely kind of acoustic phonetic effect. And so let's just very briefly kind of review this, because it'll set a basis for how to kind of think about some of the analysis of the data. All right, so vocal track, you know, what you're doing is you're blowing air out, it's kind of blowing past your vocal folds here, and then your vocal track is shaping it. So you can kind of think about this in terms of kind of the placement of the articulators along the vocal track, and that you have some sound source down here. That sound source, if you were looking down this way, are your vocal folds, right? So as you're blowing air up through your lungs, you're kind of pushing them open. The Bernoulli effect kicks in and kind of snaps them back shut, so your vocal folds vibrate. But they don't vibrate sinusoidally. They have some fundamental frequency, but then you get a rich array of harmonics tied to that. We'll come back to that in a moment. As you move around different features in kind of your vocal tract, you're kind of changing the acoustic properties of this area, and that shapes the sound. Now this is kind of nicely laid, and so we can think of this in terms of a source filter theory. And it's just a very nice linear systems approach. It's worth just spending a moment to highlight because it kind of sets a basis for how to think about some of the pieces downstream. So apologies if this is kind of just too generic review for some, but I figured it would be useful for the general audience here. So this is a figure, this is a very nice figure that's taken from Ken Stevens' book, Acoustic Phonetics. And it shows each column. It shows two different types of sounds. So we have a vowel over here, a consonant here. Now what we're looking at is we're looking at the amplitude of the spectra for a couple different pieces. All right, so this first is the source. Here's a first filter, second filter, and here's kind of all these pieces put together. So as you're blowing air up through your lungs, when you're voicing, your vocal folds are vibrating. And they're vibrating at some fundamental frequency. So here's your F0. But you get all these harmonics that kind of come down. So if you were to kind of just stick a microphone down near, right on top of your vocal folds as they're vibrating, you'll get kind of a buzzy broadband sound coming out. Now when you're doing consonants like tss, you're actually just holding your vocal folds open and you're just blowing air out. So you just kind of get a very broadband structure with no harmonics. Now, as you change the shape of your vocal tract, there's going to be some frequency response tied to that, right? So these things are what we call the formants, right? So here, let's go. So these harmonics are what we call the overtones, and that's what we call the source. The filter, based upon how you shape your vocal tract, sets kind of this spectra, which, you know, emphasizes certain features. So these peaks here are the formants and so on. And then your mouth has some kind of radiation impedance that you can kind of characterize through a transfer function. And you see kind of things looking out. And then in the spectral domain, it's just a multiplication of these things. In the time domain, it's just a convolution. So you get a signal that looks like this as the output. Okay? And so you can kind of see here for this sort of signal for like a voice vowel, these are your formants that you see along here, and for your consonant, it's just kind of a broadish band with kind of an emphasis towards higher frequencies. So this is a nice way of thinking about kind of a relatively complex problem because a lot of the complexities of all the biomechanics and whatnot are just boiled down to a relatively tractable linear systems point of view. And so this kind of sets a basis for thinking about speech signals such as vowels, for example. So, you know, you can see now this is just a slice, kind of take this thing and kind of put it along this way, and then we have, you know, for example, the spectrogram of the five vowels, right? So this is going to be the primary analysis method that I've used thus far that I'm going to talk about today. Just incredibly simple, a short time Fourier transform to get a spectrogram, right? And so, you know, we've been hearing about this all week, so this is relatively known to us. And if you look at, you know, complex, more complex signals, like such as speech, you know, you're getting kind of a broad range of different features in a spatial temporal domain. Okay. Now, this is a paper from Scientific American in 1999. And so they wrote, the title was The Throat Singers of Tuva. So they wrote, testing the limits of vocal ingenuity. Throat singers can create sounds unlike anything in ordinary speech and song, carrying two musical lines simultaneously, say, or harmonizing with a waterfall. And this last bit's kind of, the nice thing about this article is kind of, on one hand, it's talking about kind of some of the science of tuve and throat singing. But on the other hand, it nicely also lays out some of the cultural aspects, like what kind of made people develop this unique way of phonation kind of ties back to a deep kind of connection with nature and whatnot, like harmonizing with a waterfall. So they refer to this as overtone phonation. And I'll come back to this a little bit later on, but in essence, I think this is a bit of a misnomer. So overtones is another word for, as far as I've been able to kind of gather, overtones is another word for harmonics, But essentially, every time we're talking or whatnot, we're shaping the overtones from the voice state of our vocal folds. And thus, you know, just talking right now would be an example of overtone phonation. So I think this is a bit of a misnomer. So I'll come back to that a little bit later on. But this is one of the figures from the paper. So they did some recordings, and they just had kind of somebody kind of normally enunciating. And, you know, here's like we were looking at before. Here's kind of the harmonics of the vocal folds, and then you're shaping it based upon your vocal tract. So you have the formants. And when they get into this kume style of throat singing, essentially you can see that there's just one harmonic that's enormously emphasized. And somehow they can also control this a little bit independently of the harmonics themselves. So they can kind of maintain the harmonic structure, but change the formant structure. And so, you know, one of the big mysteries is how do you do this? You know, it's not something, it's one of those things where, you know, you can, after the talk or whatnot, you can just go lock yourself in your office and try and do this on your own. Yes, I will show you plenty of spectrograms. So, you know, the big question is how is this achieved? And also, too, how do you kind of do it? Like, if you notice, and we'll come back to this in a little bit, when you heard these people starting to sing, it's almost like a switch was being flipped and they go into this state. All right? So that's one of the things we want to kind of talk about. So the data that we were able to get from these guys was remarkable. It's a beautiful set of recordings that I've only started to scratch the surface of kind of analyzing. But we have a handful of really nice recordings, and I was able to kind of ask them to do most of, they couldn't really speak English very well. One of them could, but fortunately we had a former graduate student who spoke Russian, so he was able to kind of help us. So we were able to kind of get them to try and kind of do different ways where they would transition into and out of the kume style. And so this guy, this was Alexei, and he was kind of charming. He wasn't as good at it, but that also led to some beautiful data. Like there's sometimes where he's singing, if we have time, if there's interest at the end, where like he's kind of in this style, but all of a sudden he'll kind of break and he'll kind of force himself back into it. And so I think it's a very revealing bit of data. Okay, so let's look at some spectrograms. So just to kind of review, here's the sample from Roddick. Okay, so that's just the snippet as he transitions in, okay? And so here's what the spectrogram looks like, right? So here's kind of normal voicing, and then all of a sudden, as you heard, here, I'll just play it one more time. This is about 3 seconds right here. So that's the entirety of the snippet. And after, right before the first second, you'll hear the transition into that overtone focus. Okay. And so it's a very rapid transition, but you can hear, like, once he kind of gets in there, a lot of this structure, some of it stays the same, but some of it fundamentally changes. Like, you can see what kind of looks like this, maybe like a third formant. It kind of stays there, but a close by second formant just completely disappears. Right? And when he kind of, once he gets in there, then he transitions very quickly to kind of another pitch, so to say. And then he can kind of, you heard those little modulations on top of it. Right, you can see overall the harmonic structure, the overtone structure, is relatively unchanged. Right, so that's in some sense how you can get these two different salient sense of pitch. You get kind of the harmonic structure itself, which remains, but then you have kind of these overtone focus states. So that's why I think overtone phonation is not the right way to think about it. I think essentially what they're doing is they're kind of sharpening one of these formants. They're focusing it. And so thus, this is kind of an overtone focusing idea. Yeah?
The second formant, is it now is it two times?
This one? I should give you the laser pointer.
This one over here. Is it about 2 times the formant over there? So are there somehow?
Here, too. So maybe let's say 1800. So ballpark maybe to first order.
If there's a third one. This is about 3 times the one that is there.
Yep, maybe.
Chris, in this example, in the longer one you played from the older singer earlier, it seems like at any given time they're either modulating the fundamental frequency and presumably the overtone sequence above it, or they're modulating the, what it looks like the formants. And the older one was switching back and forth between doing each, but I never heard him modulate both simultaneously.
So,
do you ever see examples of that, or does that seem like a limitation that they just can't?
We'll look at the spectra, and that's a good question. I don't have a good answer to you. Like, to what extent can those two things be varied independently?
At the same time. We're doing both, but I never heard both at the same time.
The most salient perception a lot of times that you pick off is the shift of the formants. But presumably, kind of even small variations in the harmonic structure, especially at the higher ones, can actually probably have a dramatic effect, but it'll seem relatively subtle in the spectral domain, but perceptually, maybe not so much.
Can be done.
What do we hear perceptually? Do we hear which of these frequencies do we have?
Well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take two slices of this, okay? And so let's look at the spectra, and we can kind of compare those two. Okay, so here's before transitioning into kind of, this might seem like kind of relatively normalish voicing. And so you can kind of see, so one thing to keep in mind here is that I apologize that the scale bars are small, but this is 50 dB right here. Okay, so it's a big, this is a very tall spectra, so to say. And once he transitions into the second state here, a lot of that energy has been kind of brought into this. I don't even know if you necessarily call this the second formant or the first, because it's kind of, there's already, the fundamental's kind of down here. Like, another thing that's weird about this is if you take this to be the fundamental, or might even be a subharmonic, I'm not sure, the difference between these is gargantuan. Like, it's huge. Right, so understanding, this is one of the things I just started to kind of realize that, it's not even necessarily clear what the fundamental is doing and how that might also relate back to maybe some sort of subharmonic structure in the voicing. Right. But this thing becomes relatively quite large, and so thus I think from a perceptual point of view, your attention starts to kind of get focused on this kind of spectral feature right there. Now, this is a relatively... I'm going to show you guys another example in a moment. So again, coming back to overtone focusing, there's various ways we can start to kind of analyze this. So just as kind of a means to start making things a little bit more tractable, just taking this slice, what we can do is, it's not too hard to just come up with some algorithm to start doing some peak picking, but then also do some sort of, from those peaks, you can kind of do kind of a lowest locally weighted regression, and then start to kind of pull out the trend, and you can start to figure out what the harmonics are. And so then you can kind of extract those, and you can kind of track what the harmonics are doing. You can kind of track and color code the change in the formant structure, so you can kind of see those as the grayscale. And so this is kind of, this comes back to this focusing idea that somehow a lot of energy is kind of being focused into one formant in particular, and then that starts to really dominate your perception. And somehow on top of it, they can kind of make small, in this case, or large variations. I can show you some other examples where larger variations are made of these formants. Yeah.
So when they're performing this, what is the position, or what is the positional configuration of the rest of the movement?
So we'll get back to that in a moment. Okay. So that relates to another set of data that we got during the day. Yes.
It's a little wiggle, as you pointed out. Are those voluntary changes, or are those almost failures?
No. In this case, these are very precisely controlled, and he can kind of modulate this with remarkable precision. Here's another example. This is Kaigol, here's just a short version of the snippet you heard before. So this is a shorter version. It's just kind of one segment of the song, so it's about 12 seconds long. So you could hear as he kind of, he pulled that up, it's part of the song structure that they sing. So he has very fine control over this, and you can kind of see that, there's also kind of fluctuations kind of superimposed on top of that. So maybe that comes back to your question earlier, Chris, about, how much that they're varying the harmonic structure relative to the formant structure.
Even looks like, when he comes back to the same note at the end, it even looks like he's tightened that formant filter up relative to the first time when he first transitioned into it.
So here's kind of, you know, we can do a similar sort of analysis. I don't think this is all that terribly useful yet, so I'll just, and you can kind of zoom in, but this just kind of shows that, you know, you're kind of going from a state where there's a kind of a lot of energy across the spectrum to this incredibly kind of focused state. And it really gives rise to kind of a different perceptual perception of things, and thus kind of, you know, thereby kind of the aesthetic associated with the song itself. Okay? So it's a little bit clear, this notion that there's somehow they're focusing the overtones in some way.
How flexible are they? Can they change the frequency region of this?
Yeah, so
is it kind of fixed because...
Yeah, so I'll show you actually, we can come back to some other examples to kind of see, but to first order, you get, and this is a very naive way of thinking, and I'm not an expert in this, but from my understanding thus far, there's basically the first stage of people that are able to do kumai are able to just somehow get into this sort of overtone focus state. Then the next stage are kind of where the real experts start to shine, and they're the people that have really fine control and then can kind of modulate this down. Like so the example that I was showing from Ralph earlier, you know, the guy's literally doing Ode to Joy by shifting around kind of that focus state. It's quite remarkable what some people are capable of doing.
Why do you call it focusing and not resonance?
If I just look at this, I mean, it depends upon how one wants to define resonance. So, you know, maybe are they just changing the vocal state such that there's really only kind of one dominant standing wave mode in the vocal track? I was just saying focus chiefly through the lens of kind of just looking at the spectrograms, that there's a lot of energy that just seems to be focused in kind of one spectral region. So that's kind of the way of thinking for the word focus.
Can they ever get into that zone without this first vocalization?
So I'll come back to that in a moment. These guys are some of the best people in the world. So they're kind of remarkable at what they can do. And so we have kind of, I tried to get a good array of recordings such that we could kind of start to get some insight into that sort of question. So I'll return to that in a little bit. Now, another aspect to this is the dynamics. Okay, so here's a short little snippet. This one's just Roddick kind of transitioning in. So it's just kind of this 3-second little snippet. Oh, yeah.
It's the nice modulations of the fundamental that keep, you know, scaling up.
Like around here and whatnot?
Yeah. Is there a role in how they go around the resonance back and forth and back and forth in the...
Good question. I don't know, but that might be something to look at. Like for example,
because it looks like the amplitude of the focusing is such that they are going.
Might be. You know, is this? I mean, maybe another way of rephrasing it is kind of as variation of F0 kind of related to maybe kind of, you know, a byproduct of kind of trying to figure out where, you know, getting that sharp informant and then kind of locking a harmonic into it. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Something that, you know. I think we can look at the data to kind of see these sorts of things.
The frequency of these variations are pretty near to the usual bandbreadth of frequencies you would also observe. Like 5 hertz about, like if you count, if this is seconds, as far as I can see.
Yeah, so this is about...
like 3 or 4.
This is about 3 seconds right here, yeah. So here's... I want to just shift gears a little bit to kind of focus on the transition, because it's relatively quite rapid. So this is about a 3-second snippet. So let me play it. And then right before the first second is when you'll hear Roddick going into that kumai state. Okay, so I mean, it's, you know, just using this kind of spectral temporal resolution, you can see it's almost kind of like a switch literally just being flipped like that. And then, you know, once he's in here, he very quickly modulates. He doesn't need to. I mean, this is just this particular example of him doing it. But it's a very rapid transition that goes on right there. And so I think the question was raised about, just one moment, about how they go into it. So if you listen carefully, I'll play the whole snippet now. And it sounds like right before the transition, it almost seems like he might be kind of pressing his voice a little bit. So, just listen carefully right before that transition point. Now, in some of the cases, especially the singers that the other singers that were not as good as Radek, they you'd hear them kind of vocalizing normally, and then they'd really push in, it got really rough, and then it was like kind of that switch being flipped. With Radek, though, and Kaigol, they could kind of there was kind of a spectrum, so to say, no pun intended, of them kind of whether there was, you know, just it sounded like normal voicing right before that switch was flipped, or if it kind of, you know, they were pushing something such that, you know, they were forcing something in the vocal track to kind of produce that change. So thus far, it's not clear that there's kind of any obvious kind of dynamic going on right before that causes that transition. Yeah.
So they always have to start with the normal singing to get into that state, or they could just start right directly in the...
No, so you always have to start with some sort of kind of normalish phonation, and then they transition in. They can't just kind of, and then start right away. Okay, so one question is how to start thinking about these data. And so the two questions kind of that, you know, I'm chiefly interested in is just from a biomechanical point of view, you know, how, what phonetically is going on? How are they able to kind of just do this from just a basic kind of vocal track point of view? Also, in terms of these dynamics, what is the mechanism that's responsible for these sudden transitions? All right, so two ways of kind of approaching this is, you know, chiefly to first order, we have a mostly linear vocal track model that can give us some insight into here, but a little bit harder though is this question. And so if I have time, I'll just touch very briefly upon kind of some idea of, you know, is there a nonlinear dynamics point of view that might help explain what's going on? Okay, but chiefly everything is through the lens of this picture. You know, we're trying to think about what, you know, the acoustic phonetics are that give rise to this, you know, relatively remarkable ability. All right, so coming back to the source filter theory, here's kind of how you can kind of deal with this in a nutshell. Okay, very simple, straightforward way of thinking about things. Here's your lungs, they're kind of blowing air. Here's your vocal folds. And then the vocal track is just a bunch of concatenated tubes. Okay? And this is relatively straightforward to deal with. The only thing that really matters to this is, in this case, there's a radial symmetry. There need not be. But basically, in a nutshell, all the complicated acoustics is just boiled down to a tractable set of coupled tubes. And then one of the things that matters here is essentially kind of the cross-sectional area across any point along the length of the vocal tract. So as you're going along here, you're starting vocal folds to mouth, so this is kind of some dimension, let's just call it X. And so you can just think of your vocal tract. So it's curved, but to first order, you know, this little schematic is a simple way for thinking about how you do this. Right? And so this is kind of a basis for a lot of speech synthesis because it's relatively straightforward to implement these things computationally. All right. This model, I said, is mostly linear, but there is kind of some nonlinearities associated with how the flow goes into the vocal folds and the aerodynamics associated with that. But beyond that, more or less to first order, most of everything else is linear. Okay. Now, a key parameter here is the vocal tract area. So here's a nice little example. This is from a paper from Brad, where this is showing the vocal tract modulation for Ohio. Okay, so this is, think of this as X and Y. So here's kind of your vocal folds are here, your mouth is here, this would be kind of the tongue. And what it's showing is the start and the end, so Ohio. So the red and the blue are at the start and at the end. And to synthesize the Ohio sound, the vocal tract is modulated, and this is kind of showing snapshots at different points along time. Here's the formants associated with saying Ohio. But it gives you a sense for how the vocal tract cross-sectional area varies, to what extent it varies for something like the word Ohio. So if you can kind of get a sense for kind of the dynamics or maybe even kind of quasi steady state of these, you can start to kind of get some sense for how you might simulate some of these sounds for the overtone singing or overtone focused singing. Okay. Now, how do we know what this sort of vocal tract configuration is for the throat singers? Well, we could guess, but that's where the other set of data that we got when the band came to campus. So we were blown away that we could even get in contact with these guys and that the manager even agreed to put us in touch. And we thought that Roddick was going to come. And I just remember getting a call from Chandon because he was driving him in. And he's just all like, I'm on my way. I got the whole band with me. And it was just like, no shit. So we did a bunch of recordings. And then we walked down to the other side of campus. And so while they, these three kind of sat outside, Roddick went into the MRI. Okay, and we had a very limited time frame. We literally only had about a few days. So Joy, our tech, she was able to kind of get an imaging paradigm set up in time that allowed us to take this movie. And we didn't even know if Roddick was going to be able to do this sort of singing in the scanner because he had never, you know, as amazing as he is at this, he had never done it lying down. So he wasn't even sure if he'd be able to. So we got him to lay down, and he was practicing for a little while, and he was able to pull it off. And so we were able to make this recording. Now, unfortunately, so this is the sagittal on the midline. Unfortunately, he did have a root canal, so there was a post. So you'll see there is kind of a region where the NMR signal just drops out. But you can kind of get a sense for, it's not the best resolution, but I think to first order, it's good enough. So we've started to analyze this qualitatively, but I still have yet to dig into it quantitatively. Another thing that we were able to do was he was able to go into the state and keep it locked for about a 15-second spiel, such that we could also get volumetric data. All right, so even though he had the post on one side, so you can kind of see the hole in the NMR signal, we did get a nice signal from the other side. So we got nice three-dimensional data as well. And so I've yet to do it, but from these data, we should be able to kind of extract some sort of image like this of the vocal track. And so that's going to set a basis for kind of one of the key inputs into the model. Now, one thing to note down here is, I don't know too much about them, but there's these small cavities, air-filled cavities, that kind of come off to the side, and they're called the piriform sinuses. And so those seem like they matter. And so we have that data from the MRI to kind of see to what extent that they couple in. So putting all those pieces together, we can make a, you know, qualitatively to first order, we've made a guess for what the vocal tract looks like. And we can throw it into Brad's model and simulate this. Right? And so first order, this is kind of what the results look like. So you're going to hear just three short snippets. One is the original signal. One is the simulation with no piriforms coupled in. And the last one is with them in. All right, and so to first order, I mean, it still sounds synthesized, but to first order, it kind of captures kind of some of the essential spectral characteristics. All right, so I mean, we still got a ways to go, but to first order, you know, and this is, again, this is just based upon a rough qualitative guess of the vocal tract shape. It seems that we can kind of simulate the steady state case. All right, however, what's the model itself does allow for kind of a temporal dynamic, like, you know, in that Ohio example, but we haven't kind of started to try to implement that yet, and so we have to see if, you know, this relatively linearist model can kind of explain these rapid transitions.
I have a question. Yeah. So about this rapid transition, did you ever ask them to, like, try to do a slower transition?
I did, and so we have that data. Yep. So, So again, you know, if hopefully if people are getting interested, they're like, yeah, I'm going to take them up on this offer to maybe collaborate on this. Because yeah, I think we have a nice set of data along those lines. Because I asked him, I asked Roddick to kind of see to what extent he could kind of transition smoothly into and out of. Again, it was a little bit hard because of the language barrier, but we do have a nice set of recordings. And we're just looking at a tiny fraction of them here.
Was he able to do it more slowly? I mean, that's...
Off the top of my head, there was kind of a variety of transitions in and out of, but I can't give a meaningful quantitative answer to that, or even probably a solid qualitative one. So I just want to start kind of wrapping up on a kind of a note relating back to another way maybe to think about approaching these data. And it has to kind of do with the fact that, you know, these transitions into and out of do seem relatively rapid. And so to me, you know, I was, you know, as an undergrad, you know, I spent a lot of time research-wise dealing with dynamical systems. And so I always kind of had a nonlinear dynamics kind of focus kind of grilled into me. So, you know, that kind of reminded me of this, you know, this paper from 2002 about fractal dynamics. If you just, you know, it's a very well-cited paper. If you just look at table number one, nonlinear complexity mechanisms in physiology, you know, first thing, abrupt changes. Okay, so I'm just, you know, it's just instilled into me to think like, okay, well, is there some sort of fundamental nonlinear mechanism which is responsible for this kind of transition quickly into and out of? And so, you know, that kind of relates back to Feynman. One of Feynman's graduate students was a guy named George Zweig. He's actually a famous hearing scientist as well. He's also the guy who kind of independently developed the subatomic model for quarks in parallel with Gell-Mann. But I remember a piece of advice he gave me, because I remember thinking, like, this was on a cochlear problem, but it was just like, okay, well, the cochlear is nonlinear. How can we, you know, what is it telling us to have a linear model for things? And you know, he said to me, you have to walk before you can run. And so the first order, hopefully maybe the first order computational model with the concatenated tubes is our walking. And maybe now we can start to think about how to run. Right. And also, and other motivations came from things like this is a famous paper from Fee, where they looked at the vocal track of a songbird. Now, the songbird, what they did was, it was a little gruesome. They kind of excised these vocal tracks from the birds. It's important to realize that the vocal track of a bird is a bit different. They don't have vocal folds. What seems to happen is they're pushing air out, and the sides of the vocal tract kind of oscillate, and that's kind of the sound source. But when they did a variety of experiments, in kind of a relatively controlled way, they had this excise prep. They can kind of push air through it, and then they can kind of record the sound output. They saw kind of a rich set of nonlinear features. Like, for example, kind of pushing through, all of a sudden you get kind of subharmonics, and you can go into regions where things become kind of aperiodic, so kind of like a chaotic type of dynamic going on. And so there was, you know, it was this nice paper in Nature that kind of motivated, you know, songbird vocal production from a nonlinear dynamics point of view. Now, it doesn't seem that it's unique to birds. This is a paper kind of looking at rhesus monkeys, where it's kind of looking at the spectrogram of their calls, and they can kind of go into states where they get subharmonics and so on. Now, it's important to note that subharmonics in of themselves do not necessarily a priori indicate a nonlinearity. There are ways that subharmonics can arise from linear systems. So this was another figure in their paper, and it kind of started to motivate some ideas in just nonlinear time series analysis of, you know, ways where you can kind of think about, you know, just going from a simple spectrogram, here's the time waveform, here's the spectrogram, but then you can also do some sort of kind of time delay embedding and get some sort of trajectory in the phase as a phase plane portrait. So I tried to start to do that here, and I've only started to scratch the surface of this. Here's the spectrogram of Roddick that we're looking at. Here's the associated waveform. If we just kind of zoom in on a snippet here, we'll get this piece. And then just taking a very simple time delay embedding approach, I managed to get kind of, you know, so what you're doing is you're just taking the data, taking this waveform, and so that's kind of along this axis, And then you're just kind of taking one sample before and you're plotting it on this axis. So that's what each pair is on here. It's kind of a sample and then the sample right before. And so it kind of traces out a trajectory here. Now, I don't know yet if there's anything interesting there yet. I need to kind of spend some more time just thinking about what this would look like for standard signals, for noisy signals, and so on. I think people here are probably a lot more knowledgeable than I in this regard. Also, too, looking at a higher dimensional representation, and maybe also, too, just taking a slice, filtering this in the spectral domain, and then inverse transforming back, and then doing the analysis on that. So I'll just summarize here. So, you know, I think we were lucky. We stumbled upon a relatively unique and kind of nice set of data that was kind of tied to an interesting problem. To first order, we've been able to start to kind of explain it, but there's still a lot, a long way to go. You know, I think there's a lot to extract from the data, and then there's also kind of a lot to think about the most appropriate way to model it. And hopefully we can use that to tie back to some kind of knowledge about kind of the underlying biomechanics of the vocal tract and what's going on in that regard. So just to bring it back to where we started, Feynman. One of the things that was nice about Feynman was that he had a deep interest in hard problems, things, you know, that as he started to scratch the surface, it just got richer and richer and so on. One of the things that's nice, you know, besides just kind of the acoustic phonetics and the biomechanics and possibly the nonlinear dynamics and so on of this problem, was there's also like a nice aspect to this. It's just the cultural aspect. You know, this style of singing is really something that's kind of developed over, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. It's something that's very unique to these guys. And I don't know a good way to describe it, but, you know, in life, you know, you guys probably all know this. Like, there's every once in a while, it's very rare, but you meet like a certain person or maybe a small group of people, and in some way, it's just different for you. It's magical. That's how these guys were. Like, I'll never forget meeting these guys. It's almost like they were from another planet. They were the nicest, most down-to-earth people, but it was just such a remarkable set of folks. So maybe tonight, actually, assuming he's not too scared, I'll never forget Bowman, he's our two-year-old, coming up and just giving a big old fist bump to Alexi after we got these data. So if you see Bowman tonight, try and give him a fist bump. Okay, so that's all I had to say. I don't know if anybody has any questions or if anybody wants to discuss offline.
So you had that one observation about the mechanical properties or the shape involving the, I can't remember what you said, those extra sinuses on the side of the
yep.
track. Could you see that in the video? And also,
the video would have been on the midline.
Yeah, okay.
So the only place you would be able to see it would have been on the, sorry to kind of, this is not a good way. All right, so you should, if it's there, you should be able to kind of see it here. But I haven't gone into enough detail to look at those to see to what extent those are going to become apparent.
The movie looked like there was, during the sort of focused periods, there was something was opening up and getting a lot wider.
Yeah, so I mean, that would have been along the... So that would have been, because this is kind of, you know, this slice is directly along the midline. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can kind of infer maybe kind of out of plane motion, but it's a little bit hard. But yeah. But hopefully kind of comparing this, you know, these two sets of data should help kind of give some insight into what's going on.
That's just the fact that the tone went down, that wouldn't have a big impact on focusing.
Much more than just moving up and down.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see, like, you know, like, this is the tongue. And so as you're kind of moving it along, there's, you know, and this is kind of taken out of, you know, what's going on in here. So everything's kind of coupled together in a relatively complex way. Like, another thing to notice is if we go back to the video, now watch, you know, even too, just nasal coupling. You can see the phloem come, sometimes it comes down, but it seems like for the most part, when he's actually doing it, it stays closed.
Oh,
unfortunately, we lost a good chunk of the data here, but you can just see from the video that there's a lot going on in terms of kind of this region right here, that there's a lot of dynamics.
If you look at the video by Wolfgang, you can see like the tongue movements.
Yeah.
They're really delicate. I mean, I don't know how long I lost that dog.
Yeah, so the Ode to Joy video is higher temporal resolution, higher spatial resolution. It's a remarkable video, very much so. So, yes?
You said that it's a long-lasting tradition for these folks. So are there any verbal descriptions, how they teach each other or over the generations?
Good question. I don't know too much about that. I do know that when these guys go on tour, they're like an audience favorite. Like the audience just loves these guys. And afterwards, they'll always come and just try and meet people. And then when they're somewhere long enough to stay, they'll have a workshop the morning after, and they'll try and help teach people. And people love it, but you know, I think it's relatively rare that somebody's able to kind of do this. But there are people. People out there, they're relatively rare, but there are people that are capable of doing this.
And there's even a scene, a kind of a new music scene, where people really do that. I mean, even out of this cultural context, even in the Western world.
But these guys, so I mean, in Russia, they have this difficult relationship with the, you know, subcultures, not cultures, but smaller cultures, you know. And actually, I saw them play once, and in the background, they projected this movie on the kind of the Red Army taking over the steps. And it was incredible to see how it was kind of a pro-Bolshevik kind of movie, but they were just truly destroying this amazing old culture. But these guys were actually trained, you know, like they went through the, you know, in Russia, the music training is very formalized. You get selected the different things. So they actually went through the musical training academies. And so they were supported, you know, in the Soviet times by the sort of very locally. But eventually, I guess, they could call.
There's also related to that, there's another region next to Tuva, because I mean technically it was, I guess Tuva itself is now currently a republic, is that right? I think of Russia. But there's another country another republic called Altai, and they have a somewhat similar.
I think they're autonomous regions.
I just want to play, if you'll bear with me for one moment. There's one other snippet I'd like to play because it's a song. It's a little bit more. Let's see. I gotta find it. Artist. Altai Kai. Okay, so. This is a song, it kind of starts off like, it's almost like a Led Zeppelin type song. It starts off, and after about a minute, he starts singing, and then he'll go into the kumai style, but the control he has, like the first time I heard this, it just blew me away. So independent of kind of the song aspect, the guitar, I don't know necessarily what this song is about, but once he goes into the song mode, the amount of control he has is just, and kind of the aesthetic associated to it is quite remarkable. And I think in the academies where they teach this style of singing, there's very few people that kind of get to the level. And then, like, I think this artist is like one of the people that would be kind of like, you know, class valedictorian in that regard. Sorry, the guitar kind of goes on for a little bit, but it's worth hearing just to, as he kind of, so he starts with just like a normal vocal song, I think. Oh no. I mean, you can hear like, I mean, the their temporal ability to control it. So So also too, if you check out the Ode to Joy video that Ralph had kind of pointed to, I don't want to draw too much attention to it because I don't want to steal my own thunder. But it is extremely
well tempered, right? It must be natural.
Say that again. Sorry.
I mean, it's not a well tempered scale. It can only have natural tones, right? A natural scale.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to put it. Yeah.
Although we are used to, nowadays we are all used to well-tempered tuning.
So I don't want to keep folks too long. It's Friday afternoon. I know that there's another small discussion session at 3:30. So I'd just end on this note. I'd like to just propose, if there's folks that are kind of interested in discussing this more and maybe have some ideas about how to think about things or kind of ways to analyze the data, maybe one afternoon next week we can have one of these small discussion sessions and we can kind of just all sit down together and kind of focus. And we can also take a closer look at some of the other waveforms that we have that I didn't show today. Okay. All right, so I'm happy to chat with folks, but thank you, guys.